I was thinking about Yvonne Chouinard and Doug Tompkins' like trip to Patagonia.
Somehow you feel like almost a bit dirty as human to be here.
I don't know. I'm getting wiser, older.
Hi, welcome to the Vertical Podcast. Edelried decided to start this podcast to share the pleasure and freedom of moving vertically. You will discover how climbing has shaped people's lives and what they envision for the future of the sport and the places where it unfolds. Our hosts, Joe and Lena, two environmental activists, are ready to dive deep with each guest, uncovering their stories, dreams, and the impact they hope to make. Joe and Lena will take you on a journey beyond the climb, revealing what truly drives those who reach for their limits.
In this episode, we ask Tommy Caldwell the tough question, what do you actually do as a climber and an environmental advocate? So stick around to find out how he unpacked his bike and climb trip to Alaska and used it to explain what he does as an environmental advocate. Hello, everyone. I'm Joan. I'm sitting here with Tommy. I'm excited to have a chat about your projects and about kind of how you're carrying those projects forward and how come you're doing the things that you're doing.
Yeah, pleasure to be here. Thank you so much. I'm looking forward to this conversation with you. So my name is Tommy Caldwell, and I am a, it's hard to define my life in simple terms. I don't know. I guess historically I'm a professional rock climber. I'm specifically kind of focused on big wall free climbing. I've spent about 25 years of my life really kind of obsessed with Yosemite National Park and the climbing there. And so that's defined my climbing life. But in more, and I'm a father and a husband. Those are almost probably sit one step above my climbing for sure. But in more recent years, I've also really gotten into, environmental activism, kind of specifically land protections work. I'm a global sports activist for Patagonia, which means I have a job to actually try and get outdoor enthusiasts and climbers specifically fired up about environmental issues and thinking about what they can do to help in those ways.
What kind of way do you perceive limits and where do you think that you're expanding on them?
I think my brain immediately goes to like philosophy and creativity. I think the way that I think, when I think of expanding limits, I think of changing the way I view the world oftentimes. And that can come from the things that I do, my physical activities in climbing, but also the people that I meet and how they affect my inspiration.
That's a great segue into, I think, everything else that we're going to talk about today. So yeah. That's brilliant. Thank you. So when we're talking about mentality and modality, and we can talk about philosophy as well if we want to. I mean, that's definitely not off the table. Is that something that's really infusing the way that you choose which projects that you take on during the year or during the years or how you decide to take them on, like your Alaska project, for example? Do you think that's really a fruit of your values and the way that you decide to be a human and a climber?
I mean, I think I choose my endeavors in life generally based on the inspiration I draw from my community and the people around me, and then trying to like create my own spin in a way that suits me, you know, in a way that's specific to me. I'm always like, I draw my inspiration from the things that I specifically can be the best in the world at. And I don't like that term best in the world per se, you know? But if there's something that is so specifically suited to me that I can use that to explore a realm that is very exciting to me and maybe something that other people haven't really explored that much, that's when I get the most excited, you know? So like, that's why I focused on big wall free climbing in Yosemite, for instance, for so much of my life, because that's such an obscure thing, you know, that doesn't do anything to like better the world. There's nothing, but for me, it's like the thing that my experience and my skills, they've brought me to that place. And it's a place that I can explore in ways that other people haven't.
And I guess that also by really honing in on that thing that you're the best at, it allows you to also create a space for yourself within the community to then be able to talk about those topics that you are passionate about and to use your specific situation or your specific skill or the thing that you're the best at to be able to really expand on other topics that are interesting you or that are linked to that thing that you're the best at. if you hadn't followed this path in your life, maybe you wouldn't be here today and you wouldn't be able to use your position and your, let's say, platform to be able to talk about and elaborate on the topics that you're so passionate about.
But it's not based on what I actually do. It's just based on the fact that people can see my story and see me and see how excited I am about that and want to find that thing in their own lives.
That's interesting. Okay.
Yeah, because like my biggest climb, the thing that, you know, has really driven the last 10 years of my life is climbing the Dawn Wall. Like, what is the Dawn Wall? You know, like, nobody really knows what Big Wall free climbing is. It's weird, you know, like, it transcended the climbing world and everybody was so excited about it, but it's like such a weirdly obscure thing. But I think what people saw is kind of the larger principles involved. Like, I got found something that drove me for like 10 years and I was so excited about it. And I, you know, it dictated my relationships. It brought this like element of like friendship and brotherhood with the person that I'm in. It you know, I like designed new climbing gear. I focused so much in on this very weird thing, but it drove all these things that people can understand and can relate to.
Yeah, I think having like anything, having some objectives and having some goals is really, or having a objective or a goal, really helps you kind of develop everything else in your life to go in that direction. And having that energy to try and find that goal is really something special.
Yeah, totally. Like finding that thing that feels so right to you is really appealing to anybody, because I think so many people are searching for that, right? And I feel really lucky that I've found that many times in my life. And I found that with El Cap, but these days I think I've found it with the environmental work I do. Like, I think I get to this place a little bit faster than some people, where I find like this thing where I'm like, this is it, you know, this is so exciting. This is what I want to be doing. Like, I know I have this like very distinct like path forward, and it's not always like that, but I think I'm always searching for that. And when I find it, it's very cool.
It's a very nice feeling of fulfillment also, no? When you find that thing, you're like, yeah. This is the path that I'm supposed to be walking.
Yeah, and that's the expanding moments type thing that when you ask the question, that's what I was thinking about. Like when you find that moment, that thing, that's when I feel like you're expanding.
Yeah, because you find that path and your limit kind of expands around that path, you know?
Yeah.
Like maybe before it was just like a sign. It's like, okay, the path is over here. But then when you actually step onto it and you start walking it, then it just... Yeah. Just see where it's going and where it was and where it may take you. Yeah. That's a really cool feeling.
Yeah. And when you have this like preconceived notion of where your limit is and you're able to break through that somehow, that's like the coolest thing in the world.
Brilliant. Yeah. That's really cool. And so in terms of finding your new thing and your projects, how do those two realities of yours connect? Because you keep doing projects and you're going to keep doing projects, hopefully, for a long time. So how does your new enthusiasm and your new dedication to environmental work and land protection impact your projects? I'm thinking of one specific project.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's taken some time, honestly. Like I think for a long time I was a climber, and then I got a little bit involved in like political activism and mostly like trying to figure out how to keep climbing access available. So I was on the board of this organization called the Access Fund, and they had started organizing these events where I'd go to DC and I'd meet with senators and staffers and try and like help make policy that protected climbing, right?
And what do you mean by
the protected climbing? Like kept climbing areas open. Because there's always things. I mean, it's a little maybe less this way in Europe, but in the US, there's always threats that are going to close down climbing. Like there's climbing areas that are found on private land.
Okay.
And private landowners don't historically let other people come onto their land in the US. So trying to figure out how to work with the landowners to open up the climbing that's on private land or purchase the land. That's one aspect. Or there's major laws like fixed anchors in wilderness that the lawmakers want to ban fixed anchors in wilderness. So then you have to advocate to keep that from happening.
Okay. So it's a regular debacle.
Yeah. It's always happening.
Okay.
And so anyways, my work with that got me involved in just like activism and advocacy in general. And then my real interest has become more about climate change stuff. So I can use those skills and the relationships and everything that I developed about climbing access and try and utilize that for like environmental work. And so that gave me this job that I now have at Patagonia. You know, I've been a Patagonia ambassador for 15 years or something. But a couple of years ago, they're like looking at their roster and they changed their mission statement at Patagonia to "We're in business to save our home planet." And so they're trying to figure out how to take every aspect of the company and push it more in that direction. And they're looking at the ambassador team and they're like, Tommy is the only one who really like cares about this stuff really. So we'll actually change him into like having a job, make him an employee. And now my job is with Patagonia is to, you know, activate climbers behind environmental issues, but also the world beyond climbers when possible. But because I do that at Patagonia, my mind is just always in that space. So it transcends my other sponsors as well. Cause every responsible outdoor brand is essentially trying to figure out ways to do similar things.
And would you say that then this job is really permeating your mentality and your modality for the way that you approach your professional and personal projects?
Yes, absolutely. Like, I spent most of my climbing life doing climbs, and this is totally fine. I think this was important, doing climbs that were meant to, what's the way to put this? Like stroke my own ego, like prove that I was good enough to myself and to other people. Like
to be the best.
Yeah, to be the best. Like, yeah, I would pick climbs where I was like, okay, I can do this climb and I'm going to show myself that I'm the best in the world at this. Right. And that was great. And it, you know, it brought me to great places, but at some point it feels pretty self-serving.
Does it feel constricting as well?
Maybe like at some point, like, especially when, you know, I'm 45 now and my physical abilities are a little bit harder to come by in some ways than they used to be. And I realized that I'm not going to be physically the best. I'm far from physically the best. I actually have never really been physically the best at climbing. I find ways that I use my other skills in life besides my physical abilities to help me thrive. But especially these days, I'm like, I'm not going to be able to do the hardest climbs in the world in any realm. For a while, I couldn't do the hardest sport climbs or boulder problems in the world, but I could do the hardest big wall climbs in the world because I had these other skills that I had developed that helped me do that. But now I can't do that anymore either. So I'm trying to find ways to keep the creativity and motivation and figure out what is most suited to me. So right now, in adding in the environmental elements and combining it with my climbing feels like my sweet spot. And honestly, it's been a little bit hard to figure that out for a while. Like how it seems like a weird thing to do is like combine environmental activism and climbing. But my trips these days seem to be working and kind of nailing it. And I can give you examples.
Yeah. Would you like to talk about your most recent trip to Alaska?
Yeah, sure. So
a very nutshelly context to what the trip was.
Yeah.
And then the stuff that I'd be really curious to talk to you about, apart from like what did you learn and how was like this new approach to climbing. But it was really like, do you think that this is going to be a modality of yours? Has this impacted the way that you're gonna develop projects in the future?
Totally. Yeah, certainly will. But yeah, so the idea came from some of my Patagonia work. One thing that I do is I'm on calls with some of the environmental nonprofits that Patagonia supports. They support thousands of nonprofits around the world, but there's a few like kind of key ones that I'm on calls with every once in a while. And one that has profoundly affected my life is this organization called the Alaska Wilderness League, and their main, you know, their environmental group in Alaska. And I mean, my perception, Alaska contains most of the United States, you know, true wilderness, like the most untrammeled land is in Alaska. So I've gotten pretty passionate about trying to protect pockets of Alaska to use as this reminder of what the world looks like without huge human impact. And so pretty early on, I went on a trip to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and used a cool climbing adventure there to kind of bring awareness to that place and help with an issue, because the oil and gas companies have been really trying to get at it. It's been a decades long fight, but it's ongoing. But this trip this last summer to Alaska was it was about a different issue called the roadless rule, where one of the ways to save the old growth in Alaska is prohibit road building. And so it's been this thing that's bounced back and forth in different administrations.
But by old growth, sorry, I'm just thinking about our non-American listeners.
Big trees.
Old growth equals big trees. Perfect.
Yeah, big tree, you know, really, really, you know, thousand-year-old trees. You know, most of all of them have been cut down, definitely in Europe. There's still some left in the U.S., and we're trying to protect them because they actually sequester way more carbon. It's like there's so many reasons to keep them. The biggest temperate rainforest in the world is in southeastern Alaska, and there's still some old growth there, and we're trying to figure out how to protect it. So I'm on a call with the Alaska Wilderness League, you know, trying to figure out if I as a climber can help, like, push this legislation called the Roadless Rule, which prohibits road building, which makes it so that the logging companies can't get to the trees anymore.
So no road equals no cutting down of trees.
Yeah.
No cutting down of big trees.
Of big trees, yeah.
Big trees.
And there's a bunch of other strategies to try and protect old growth, but this one seems likely to be a successful strategy. But anyways, as I'm learning about this, I'm like, okay, as a climber, what can I do? So I started talking to him, like, what is there climbing around there? And
what happens to be in that area?
Yeah. And so they're like, yeah, there's this range called the Stikine mountain range. And this central mountain in the Stikine is this mountain called the Devil's Thumb, which is like, if you know about climbing lore, it's like one of the most mythical, like hard to climb mountains in the world. And I was like, the Devil's, really dangerous mountain. It's like, you know, I've read about it in John Krakauer's book Into the Wild. Like his, there's two chapters dedicated to it. His like formative climbing experience as a child was trying to go as a late teen was trying to go to the Devil's Thumb and climb it.
It's it was like very this, heroic, yeah, wasn't it?
Like epic story, yeah. Super epic story. And I'm like, this is in Tongass National Forest. Wow. Like this is it. This is perfect. This is what I need. And so I've made a lot of films, and I've been involved in a lot of films in the past. And I was like, if I can, and I've worked on legislation enough that I know that if, like, the real way to save places like this is to just make people aware of them so that public sentiment becomes that they want to protect it. That's what worked in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. So most people don't know what Tongass National Forest is. They have no idea. So I'm like, if I can make a film about climbing in Tongass National Forest and then just kind of seed in these little activism elements, that's, in my mind, the most effective way to get people to care. Because if you lead with activism, so many people just tune out.
Yeah. So yeah. The act is to not have the roads, yes?
Right.
Correct.
Yeah.
And so the idea is that you use the film and you use the project as a way to have conversations with the people who are the decision makers and the policy makers to be able to bring forward your proposal and your request.
Totally. Yeah, and a secret that I figured out by going to DC for the Access Fund is, like, you know, you have the senators and the politicians, but the people who really are, like, deciding everything are all their staffers. And with climbing being such, and then they bring the ideas to the politicians and then convince them to vote in one way or another. And it turns out the staffers are basically all climbers. Like, there's a cool climbing gym in DC. Everybody goes to them. They're all kind of young. It's like, so when we as climbers go, we can get direct FaceTime with the staffers very easily. And then they get us in front of their bosses pretty often because they're just like stoked to hang out with us because they're all climbers. And so it seems
that's a great secret, I think.
Yeah.
It's perfect.
Totally. And it's a strategy that like the Access Fund and the American Alpine Club figured out. And I didn't believe in it at first. I was like, how can climbers actually make a difference? There's no way. We don't have a voice. And then you go there and you're like, you start to understand like how it works. And you're like, oh, actually, like, we can make a difference. This is pretty cool.
Cause this is another big topic, isn't it? Is that you're a climber and your whole life is about climbing and it's become your job and you've inserted other things into it. But the majority of people do something and are climbers.
Yeah.
You know, like they have a job, they're a staffer in DC and they're climbers. And so this duality that people have is actually very functional to the environmental cause and to the environmental movement, because it means that thing that connects everyone, which is climbing or the outdoor community in general, is actually an addition to the thing that people do as a regular time, like as an everyday job, and that can bring change and can bring systematic change, because we're always talking about systematic change and individual change, and what people do as their individual behavior is one part, but then obviously the work that you're doing with Patagonia and as a professional athlete and as a spokesperson for the movement is exactly the other side, you know?
Yeah.
So it's really important.
And then the other thing that we figured out is, like, most lobbyists, which is a dirty word, but it's kind of what I do, Like they just come and then they just like talk about economic numbers. And it's like, you know, after a while for the staffers, it's, they just like their eyes roll back in their head and they're just like, oh my God, it's like just the same
stop
thing
over
and
over.
Yeah. And climbers come and we just tell stories of like rad adventures we went on and they're like, they're psyched. It's like fun in the room and it totally changes the vibe. And so, they really look forward to the groups of climbers coming and it gives them a moment to like, just kind of celebrate what many of them love anyways, which is climbing.
This trip that you did to Alaska, kind of what was the summary of, give me the pitch of this project. What did you guys do?
Yeah, so I learned the Devil's Thumb was in Alaska and there was the environmental fight. And I was like, those are the key things that make me, you know, make doing a trip worth it. I was coming off a 2-year injury. I hadn't had a big adventure in 2 years. So I was like insanely adventure starved.
You were hungry.
Yeah, I was hungry. And then I had, met Seb, your previous interviewer in Yosemite, and had conversations with Lena and these other climbers from Europe who are really kind of pursuing and being creative with this idea of eco-pointing. And when I met Seb in Yosemite, he was like on this epic trip where he had sailed all the way from, you know, from Europe and then driven across the US and, you know, he doesn't fly in airplanes. And he, you know, I met him in Yosemite and had, he had this crew of people that he had been on this 6-month adventure with. And they were like living in this little van and they're just like on this epic journey, you know, like you could see it in their eyes. They're like, this is rad. This is like this big life thing. Whereas most people fly in an airplane and they drive to Yosemite and it's like just this little blip on their lives. But for them, this is like a major thing. And you could just like their energy was so cool. And I was like, honestly, a little envious. So I was like, I want to create.
I want that too.
Yeah, I kind of want that. You know, I want that in my life right now. And then I started to think about that. And the idea of eco pointing is interesting to me in the fact that you're inspiring people to not take public transit and that's better for the world. That's like one element that I find kind of intriguing.
To take public transit.
You're to take public transit or just not drive or fly in planes. That's kind of a little bit of the beauty. But the beauty in it, in my mind, is that they're expanding an idea that has always existed in climbing. And that is, if you put guardrails up around your adventure, it can expand the magnitude of the adventure a lot. Like, if you think of Himalayan alpinism, the idea of not using oxygen, like totally changes it, right? Like now if you go and climb with oxygen, it's like, it's still rad. But the people who don't do it with oxygen, those are the ones that are really like, you know, using the creativity and expanding the limits. And you know, in rock climbing, it's like if you trad climb, you don't bolt everything. You have to use what's naturally there. That's kind of doing the same thing. I think eco pointing in my mind is just like an extension, a reinvention of that for like the modern age where we're really caring a lot about like carbon output and environmental activism. So what we do is we put these limits on our adventures through not flying in airplanes or not driving, and it can greatly expand the magnitude of the adventure. That's what really appealed to me. And I understood that they're doing it in Europe where there's great public transit to a lot of places and, you know, things are closer together. And I was like, would this actually work on a North American scale where we don't have the public transit and things are so far apart? So I wanted to do a case study, basically. So there were so many elements that came together. And then I actually had a friend, Colin Haley, and Mikey Schaefer, two friends actually, who had climbed the Devil's Thumb like 5 years earlier. And they did what most climbers do these days is they just check the weather from their home in Seattle. And then when the weather forecast looked good, they got on an airplane and flew right to the base of the mountain in a helicopter. They climbed the mountain, took them like, you know, a week total, and then they came home. And so the whole Devil's Thumb adventure was pretty small, you know?
How come a helicopter to the base of the...
Because the mountain is 50 miles from... The nearest point of civilization.
Okay.
Yeah, you got
it. It's not a question
and
of
it's
driving
blocked,
up.
And it's blocked by either this, like historically, John Krakauer and stuff, they hiked up this glacier for 2 or 3 days that that was relatively easy to travel on back then. But now the glacier, a good section of it, has turned into this like slush-filled lake with walls on either side. And it's impassable. You can't go that way anymore.
Okay, so the helicopter is necessary because there used to be a glacier and now it's just slush.
Yeah. And so our trip kind of took on this incredible life because we had to figure out how to get to the... So the idea was to use this eco-point idea to get from my home in Colorado all the way to Alaska without driving, without using internal combustion engines, figure out how to get to the mountain, get around this glacier that you can't really go up anymore and like make it all the way to the mountain. And then as I was planning the trip, I was like, man, I actually just went on Google Maps and I just like typed Devil's Thumb into Google Maps and hit the bike directions button and it gave me like a line. And I was like, oh, this line goes right by Mount Hooker, which has great big walls, and the Bugaboos in Canada. And so I was like, oh, this is like turning into this incredible like whole summer long adventure where I'm going to start on my bike, I'm going to ride, I'm going to stop at various places and climb things that I would want to climb anyways. I'm going to eventually make it to the Devil's Thumb and it's just like,
it's all going to be great.
Yeah, it's going to be great. It's like this incredible.
Please don't tell me you trusted Google Maps directions.
We did actually.
No.
and it was one of those things where sometimes you want to plan specifically and sometimes not planning specifically makes it hard, but can also make the adventure.
That's true. But just Google Maps bike.
Yeah, the bike thing doesn't work.
Good. It's so bad.
Yeah.
Is it bad in the US as well?
Oh yeah, it's terrible.
It's terrible.
Yeah.
So bad.
But so my idea originally was to have this very soulful, like solo journey where I was just going to meet up in friends that always already lived in these places and just bike by myself. But as I was thinking about it, I was thinking about Yvon Chouinard and Doug Tompkins' like trip to Patagonia that was like the origin story for the company in some ways. And they had this like incredible friendship and a few other of them. And I was like, I kind of want that too. Like, I want to do this with a friend. So I invited Alex Honnold, who's my main climbing partner these days. And his original response was like, oh, I'm about to have a baby. Like, there's no way I can do this.
I can't follow Google Maps all the way to the Devil's.
Well, he's like 2 months on a bike. Like, it's just going to take way too much time. But I think he felt the same things I felt. And he's like, I have to figure out how to make this happen. And he had this work obligation to do a National Geographic film. I think they were going to go to Africa or something. He's like, why don't you pitch this idea of the Devil's Thumb to the producers that are producing this idea and see if they'll change the idea so we can do this trip together. And so I did that and it worked. They decided to change the idea, which was mostly great. Like, all of a sudden we're trying to raise awareness for Tongass National Forest and we're making a Nat Geo film. That's like a big deal.
Pretty impacting, I would say.
Yeah. But it also blew up my idea of having a soulful journey and a low carbon journey too, because suddenly we have a film crew with us and they're driving and people are flying in airplanes and they use helicopters. And it was certainly the most high carbon trip I've ever done in my life in the end.
Okay.
But you know, I guess I justified it. It was still, it was like a proof of concept and it was also a way to raise awareness. It makes me want to do a very soulful, low impact journey like this sometime in my life, but this became something different than that.
It took on another life of its own.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that in this kind of case, it's really when you talk about not so much the footprint of a project, but you talk about the handprint of a project.
I don't know. I've never heard that.
Ooh, okay. So, yay. Yeah. So the idea of the handprint of an action, of a project, of an initiative of your life, I guess, is the idea that it's not so much about how much negative impact that action had, but how much positive impact that will have in the future.
I like that. That's a way to distill something that I've been trying to articulate for a while.
There you go. All you needed to do was sit on this lovely wooden couch.
Yeah, that's nice.
In Germany. And so then you guys cycled from Colorado all the way to the Devil's Thumb. How long is that?
Yeah, so we biked 2,400 miles in total.
2,400 miles. Yep. Know that in kilometers.
Biked 3,800 kilometers over about 24 days on the bike.
Cool.
We stopped and climbed in Mount Hooker. We spent 5 days climbing Mount Hooker, and then we spent a week climbing in the Bugaboos along the way.
Nice.
And we made our way all the way to the Inside Passage, and then we sailed the Inside Passage of Alaska, which was very cool.
So you got your sailboat in?
Yeah, Nat Geo chartered us this little sailboat with a small crew of people, and I loved sailing. I'd never sailed before, but it was really incredible. We saw, you know, incredible wildlife, and then on the way we actually stopped as we were sailing. We stopped on this island called Prince of Wales, which was kind of ground zero for logging in the 70s and 80s in Tongass National Forest. And I met up with this incredible indigenous activist there that named Marina Anderson that I had met at a climate conference in Miami. And she...
Of course. Where else would you meet, where else would you meet someone from Tongass National Forest?
Yeah. But anyway, she's like doing, you know, unbelievable work. One of the most impassioned people I've ever met. And she showed us the ways of her people and the ways of the forest and kind of what she thinks needs to happen. So we spent 3 days with her kind of trying to understand the viewpoint of the people that have been there for millennia, and which was huge, which was really cool. And then we
I imagine that really impacted the way that also you approached, because that was like right before you entered the National Forest in an important way for the rest of, like, for the conclusion of your trip, for the climax of your trip.
Yeah.
So I can imagine that was a really, really strong encounter.
Yeah. I mean, it made me understand that my sense of community and place is non-existent, basically. Like, if you have a heritage, you know, generations of people that have grown there, that have like lived there and like lived off the land. And, you know, she spends most of her summer months like fishing and then distributing, like she basically is the giver of the bread to the community. They don't have a whole lot of money there because the boom and bust cycle of logging has basically left the place in shambles, kind of impoverished. So they've had to revert back to these subsistence ways of living, kind of, in a lot of ways. And so she is the provider of food for so many people. They can't do it themselves. And so we learned about that. And it was cool. It was very impactful. And the place is wild. Like, there's, you know, grizzly bears everywhere and huge salmon runs. And
wow.
You know, you can just walk through the forest and just pick berries off the bushes and be full at the end of the day. It's like the
very like fairy tale.
Yeah, the abundance of like natural some like food there is like unbelievable.
The natural nutrition that exists.
Yeah. I think before Western ideas of like money came into the whole situation, it was probably one of the most wealthy places in the world if you define wealth through like the just ease of gathering the things around you. And now it's one of the poorest places in the world by our kind of modern standards of looking at it.
And when you say that your sense of community is nothing compared to the to what you experienced there on Prince of Wales Island. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was just like this. That the Nat Geo film basically has turned into just like a bromance film, you know. And so this trip, I call it a ground truthing trip, where I went there and I experienced it. You know, I'm like in the dirt, I'm in the plants, I'm tasting it, I'm feeling it. It's all over me. And
I ate all the berries.
Yeah, and the ground is like in part of me, especially if you're on a bike for 2 months and you're suffering so much every day. Like, you become part of the landscape, and it kind of takes that mental space in a way to truly feel passionate and to love it. And so that's kind of, and then therefore like fight and be motivated to do the things to try and protect it.
Absolutely. And I think that what you just said about cycling really lets you do that, really lets, not only allows you to physically get the dirt on you and for it to become part of you, because if anyone who's listening to us has been on a cycling trip where you're not on road all the time, it's just ingrained in you at a certain point, the amount of dirt and landscape is just in you. And you're really like cycling through landscapes really allows you to be exposed to all of it.
Yeah.
The rhythm with which you're moving, being exposed to the elements, how you interact with the elements. Your whole day is based on where do you find shade? Where do you find the easiest path to cross so that you're not like dying of struggle the whole time? Like, all of these different elements that are so keen to traveling by bike or to traveling slowly in general, like the same thing can be said about walking or hiking or running even. But all of this to say that I think that that's where there's a lot of value, or that's where the main value I think is in eco point climbing.
Yeah, totally.
Is in the connection that you're establishing with the territory and with the landscape to be able to get to the thing that you want to do, the fun thing.
Yeah.
I personally think that the cycling is the fun thing.
No, I agree. Yeah, I absolutely agree. Yeah.
That's why it's also so powerful. So.
Yeah. And the trip was powerful in that we found positive things about connecting with the land, but there was also negative things, like traveling through central British Columbia, for instance. Like, I had this wrong impression that central British Columbia is so far up there that it's, you know, vast wilderness. But when you go there, you realize that everything has been cut down. And this trip was about like saving the trees, essentially, right? And we traveling
just
for,
the big ones though.
Yeah, we're traveling through a week, a solid week, 100 miles a day on a bike, where everything's been cut down. It's just completely demolished. And then all the towns that you drive through are like totally impoverished. Like you think you cut down the way that they talk about it is like if you cut down the trees to boost the local economy, right? Mm-hmm. But you look at that after that's been going on for 30 years or whatever, and the towns are just in shambles. You see people smoking crack pipes right out in the open. There's like billboards of like, don't hitchhike because you're going to get abducted. We saw like domestic abuse. We saw like all this gnarliness. And in my mind, I'm like, this is all because we've raped the land. And now the people there are suffering because of it. But then you see forest. But we had a film crew with us, right? So we have drones and stuff. So we'd launch the drones and they'd go up in the air. And then you see there's like 100 feet of trees. And then everything beyond that is just totally clear cut. So they try and give people that are driving through the impression that there's still forest there, but there really isn't.
So what's the word I'm looking for? It's like a farce.
A little bit, yeah. And I'm sure I'm painting probably the grimmest possible interpretation of what they're doing, but then you get to the points of civilization, the towns along the way, and they have pulp mills and there's smokestacks and, you know, you just see all of the logging industrialization that is also impossible to hide. And then you see the largely impoverished communities that live all around them.
So you feel like you were kind of being tricked into thinking that it was going to be, or that it is something because you see all of this lush forest right next to the road, but then the evidence is very much there of how the extractivist nature of the economy then impacts the people and the land as well.
Yeah, I mean, I just have come to believe that the extractive industries have very strategically tried to keep the biggest impacts out of sight. And so I saw that there. That's why. So Tongass National Forest is a vast area, still has some old growth, but about like 80% of it, 80% of the trees got cut down in the 70s and 80s, even in that area. And the reason that could happen is because there's hardly anybody that lives there. Okay. Like if you were to go to Yosemite National Park and cut down all the trees, there'd be this giant outcry. So what they do is go to places that there's not a giant outcry.
So then that brings us back to kind of the very beginning of this conversation, which is about bringing attention to these areas and to these issues. So that even if there's not a lot of people living in Tongass National Forest or around Tongass National Forest, there can still be the outcry that you would say that would happen in Yosemite if they were to cut down trees. Like that can happen on a wider scale because more attention is brought to the issue.
Yeah, and that's my job as a climber who's very used to traveling to remote places. I usually historically have done that to go climbing, but now I can, you know, and I've made films and written articles, and now I can just like use the filmmaking and the article writing experience and community that I've built and like hopefully direct it towards raising awareness for these places.
So I'm glad that people like you are telling good enough stories about it to foster that kind of connection for people.
Totally. And then we didn't even talk about the Devil's Thumb at all. And that's, maybe we don't have to, you know, it would go forever. But that was, you know, the film is primarily focused on the actual climb and getting to the climb that we actually did because we thrashed through the forest for like 4 incredibly epic days and climbed, you know, this mountain that is by the numbers the most dangerous mountain in the world. And even just that part of the trip, it seemed only like a small part, but any other trip that would have been
the whole thing.
Yeah, it would have been massive, you know.
And was the mountain as dangerous?
No.
This is a really stupid question.
Yeah, no, it's so funny because climate change has affected that place so much that the historic approach, you can't get to the mountain in the first place. But the mountain itself used to be this ice encrusted, you know, like incredibly intimidating mountain. And now we went and we got there in like mid-August, so late summer, and the snow was gone. Like the glaciers are gone. The mountain was totally dry. So that, you know, historically it's like people have been avalanched off of it and you climb it in very alpine styles. We got to the mountain and we're like, we can just put on our rock shoes. And, you know, Alex and I, you know, our skills that we've developed in Yosemite is that we're really good at moving over dry rock very quickly. And so we not only climbed the mountain, we climbed the entire mountain range, which was like 7 summits, like something like 75 pitches or something in a day. So we travel for 2.5 months to get there. We get there, we climb the whole range in a day. And it wasn't even that hard.
Wow.
And it didn't seem that dangerous.
Because in Into the Wild, it was really about like, this really icy mountain that it was like this like really heroic situation that it was like,
yeah,
you know, battling the elements and and getting there and all the things that in, let's say a book that was written, I don't actually know how many years.
Yeah, 30 years ago, maybe.
Really? Yeah.
Something like that. I don't know.
That was written a while ago. Even just that, how much has changed due to the impacts of climate change and due to global, the warming of the planet. Like,
yeah. And it's partially climate change. It's partially like we unlocked some possible elements. Like people thought that because of the ice and snow, you needed to have the mountain frozen together to
be able to actually
decrease
get up.
The dangers. Yeah. But we realized that, that there's no chance of it being frozen together anymore. So we just have to deal with the dry mountain, which in this case, actually, I mean, there was loose rock. Like we're, you know, the way we climb is very delicately and, you know, we're not hauling bags and, you know, it's always kind of critical to climb in this very light style because of the quality of the rock. Sure. But it, you know, it just worked. And actually the Devil's Thumb holds what many think is the last remaining great prize in North American alpinism is the northeast face of the Devil's Thumb. It's a 7,000 foot face, huge face, and it's never been climbed. And a lot of people say it never will be climbed because the temperatures from the top of the mountain to the bottom makes it so that it's never in good condition.
There's always be some bits There's, that aren't.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we, when we got there, we're like, this is no longer true. Like somebody who's just a little bit crazy could probably, because the climbing didn't look hard actually. And the mountain's dry now. So we're like somebody who, but the rock's really bad. And so like somebody who's a little bit crazy could probably free solo this thing in like a day.
Okay, so the last great North American prize
is there for somebody that's a little bit crazy and doesn't care about their lives that much. They could go do it. Probably.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So this part wasn't part of your project for the journey.
We didn't do that phase. No, we're dads. You know, like we knew enough from Mikey Schaefer and Colin that from their trip that we're like, we think as dads we can climb this mountain that people think is dangerous, and we can climb it in a safe way. We're gonna stay on the ridge lines. We're gonna, you know, climb the faces that are good rock. We don't want to risk our lives. Like the danger is not why we came. It created the lore in a way, but we didn't want to do anything that was super dangerous.
Fair enough. So now that you've done this, this quite large scale EcoPoint project,
mm-hmm.
what do you think about EcoPointing in the US versus EcoPointing in Europe? I don't know if you've ever been EcoPointing in Europe.
Actually. Yeah. I think in the US, it's certainly not practical. Like you need an extreme amount of time and very
hard to come by.
Yeah, and that's the privilege that we have as climbers that sometimes people underestimate. Like, you know, people talk about your value in terms of money, but which a lot of climbers don't have a lot of that. But the time is really where it comes from, and eco-pointing just takes a long time, especially in North America. And you have to be willing to get on your bike and ride for days and days if you're not going to drive. So I think for almost everybody, it's not going to be practical. But I think the idea is still very compelling. Like as I talk about the story, I've had travel companies come to me and they're like, we want you to help us develop EcoPoint trips. Like we want to advertise, you know, like set up trips where people, you know, come to us and we put everything in place and they do these basically like EcoPoint trips and it's like a commercial opportunity for them in a way. So people really love the idea of it. But it's not like suddenly everybody's going to be like,
instead of driving to the crowd,
yeah,
they're
going to be cycling. I don't think that's going to happen in North America.
Okay. But if it did, let's say it did.
Yeah.
What do you think would be, do you think that the climbing community would change? Because it's something so, it almost feels dramatic. Like the amount of time and the amount of days and the amount of kilometers that you'd actually have to eat up to be able to climb.
I mean, I think at the very core high end, it'll become more of a thing. It's almost like climbing Himalayan peaks without oxygen or something.
Mm.
Like that's going to appeal to people as a way to expand the magnitude of their adventure. But as a way to reduce carbon,
reduce carbon. It's more about the connection thing about slow traveling.
Yeah, and it will appeal to people who want to connect with the landscapes for sure. People that have enough time. So I think there's something there. Like the whole, just the idea behind it is inspiring. And awesome. And the way that it formats the adventure is incredibly cool. And it does tell this story about being like cognizant of your environmental impact. And so if it can happen with your climbing, which for climbers, that's one of the things they care the most about, maybe that can transcend into other aspects of their lives as well.
Yeah, they use it as almost as a trigger to elaborate other thoughts.
And I believe in my very, you know, Tommy Caldwell way of thinking about things, that really what makes the biggest impact is the policies and the laws. And so we can use these stories to affect that. And that's what will truly make the change that is necessary. But not driving to the crag, that doesn't really like make the change that's necessary in my mind. But the story that comes through that can.
Okay. The last thing I'm just going to ask you is, what would you like, if people take one thing away from this conversation that we've had, what would you like people to take away in terms of like a message or an action?
I don't know. I kind of like what we were talking about like really spending a lot of effort, like focused on finding that thing that is like best attuned to you as a person. I feel like that, I liked that, you know, like I think a lot about that. I think that's where maybe one of the places I've gotten it right is I spend a lot of effort trying to think about where I am in life and how I'm going to like maximize that specific thing.
Well, I really like that opening bit as well, because I think it's relevant to whomever, independently of where they are, what they're climbing or how they're climbing.
And I think people, like, it can be really obscure too. Like I said,
the more obscure, the better.
Yeah. It's fine. As long as you're psyched about it, that's all that matters.
Totally. Brilliant. Thank you so much for being here with us. And this has been a great chat.
Yeah, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for listening. If you like our podcast, feel free to subscribe, share an episode with your friends and family, and leave a comment below.